Okay, good evening and welcome everyone to the third and final class in this series that is covering, initial run through the popular sefer Bilvavi Mishkan Evne, which means in my heart I will construct a sanctuary. And what I'll do for the benefit of those who may not have been here before is to very briefly recap the first two sessions, actually just the second session, and we'll try to make some progress tonight, which will pretty much cover almost about two-thirds or three-fourths of the entire book. As I mentioned, this is a very popular book currently, and it's pretty much sweeping many, many different segments of the Jewish world. And I think one of the main reasons that this book has become so popular is that it addresses a frustration that many people have with their Jewish practice, which is that we may be engaging Judaism as a religion, we may be actually practicing many aspects of the religion, and it often doesn't feel very spiritual. And I think that's a very widespread frustration. People often report that they don't feel inspired when they're going to synagogue and praying, and just their general life implementing the rituals and the teachings of Judaism often leave people in our modern world feeling a bit flat. And so this book came to really kick our Judaism up to a different level, to a different notch. And I think that's what explains partially its great popularity. One of the people that today has been helping popularize this book, Bilvavi Mishkan Evne, is Rabbi Moshe Weinberger, who is the Rav of the Kehillah of Esh Kodesh in Woodmere, New York. And he tells a very famous story that I think helps explain the position of this sefer. It's a story that's told about Rav Simcha Bunim of Pshischa, one of the great Hasidic masters of the previous generations. And he told the story of someone who had a vision, a dream, to be able to purchase the most expensive and the most famous horse in the whole realm. And he took quite a bit of his money and he invested it in a prize horse. He spent a fortune. And he said to himself, well, now that I have this fabulous horse, I have to take care of it properly. And he constructed the most amazing stable that you can imagine for a horse. It was quite unlike any other stable that existed, because this was the most famous and the most expensive horse in all of Poland. And so he built this stable, and then he realized that he had to have a proper security system. And so he installed the most expensive and complicated lock to lock this stable, make sure that it'll be secure. And finally he said, you know what, it's not just enough to have this fancy stable and a very expensive lock. I'm going to hire a guard, a full-time security guard, to make sure that everything is okay. And so he went to bed that first night. And many wealthy people have a hard time sleeping. You know, the Talmud says, marba nechasim, marba daiga. The more possessions we have, the more worries we have. And this poor horse owner had trouble sleeping because he was worried that somehow the horse was not going to be safe. And so at 2 o'clock in the morning, he got up because he wanted to see if everything was okay and if the guard was still awake. He was afraid that the guard would fall asleep on the job. So he comes down to the stable at 2 o'clock in the morning, and he's surprised to see that the guard is still there, wide awake. And he says, I'm very happy to see that you're awake. He says, how do you do it? What's your secret? So the guard says, you know what I do to stay awake is I ponder very, very difficult and complicated questions that are very hard to figure out. I sit and I think about these questions. So the owner of the horse said, well, what are you thinking about? What are you trying to figure out now? And he said, I'm trying to figure out when people nail a nail into a piece of wood, where does all the wood go? When you knock that nail into the wood, what happens to all the wood? So the owner rolled his eyes and said, okay, you know, I'm glad that you're thinking. Just keep up the good work and keep thinking about these kind of questions. So he tried to go back to sleep, but he still couldn't. He came back down at 4 o'clock, nervous that this guard was falling asleep on the job. And he sees that he's still wide awake at 4 o'clock in the morning. He says to him, "So what are you thinking about now?" So the guard says, "Well, now, you know, I'm thinking about something else. I was wondering, when they make bagels, where does the dough go from the hole? They have a hole in the bagel, and what happens to all the dough? Where does it go?" So the owner again says, "You know what, it's great. Keep on thinking, and it's important that you think about these issues because it's helping you stay awake." So he tries going back to sleep, but it doesn't work. He comes back at 6 o'clock in the morning now, and again, he's thrilled to see that this guard is still awake. And he says to the guard, "Good, you're still awake. So now what are you pondering?" And the guard says, "You know, I was wondering. There's someone who purchased the most expensive horse in all of Poland, and he built the most amazing stable system to keep this horse, and he installed the most expensive lock that you can imagine. And this person even went to the extent of hiring a security guard to take care of everything and to wash the horse. So I was wondering, if that all is true, why is the horse missing?" So the story comes to illustrate an unfortunate reality that we have in our world today, is that we have all the tools and all the equipment for practicing Judaism. We're able now to put, you know, our prayer book on our Palm Pilots, and we're able to get 16,000 different foods that they're kosher, and each one has 10 different, you know, organizations certifying that the food is kosher, and you're able to get Torah classes on the internet at any time of the day. There is so much Judaism available to us, and we have so much that allows us to practice everything. There's no lack of resources. We have every possible imaginable tool to allow us to practice the Torah today. In our practice of Judaism. And the Sefer Bilvavi, this book, Bilvavi and Mishkan Evneh, is really coming, hopefully, to return the horse to us, to get us to really appreciate that everything we do, all of our practice, all of our Torah study, all of our prayer, all of our mitzvot, all of our chesed, really is supposed somewhere. It's supposed to bring us somewhere. And that's the spiritual goal and the spiritual essence of all of Judaism, which unfortunately often gets lost in the shuffle. And this is the upfront and very direct goal of the book, which is to help each of us connect with God in a very personal way, in a very palpable way, so we feel His presence in our lives. And we saw that the Sefer, the book, is built upon a program of different steps. It's a stepped program, and we're supposed to practice each step until we assimilate it and we are able to own that step before we move on to the next step. But obviously in a three-week class, we can't wait for that kind of work. It can take months or even years until we're able to finally feel that we've assimilated each step. It's a tremendous amount of work. It's not impossible. It's not difficult. We mentioned earlier that none of these steps requires any special equipment or any special intellectual gifts or any kind of fancy philosophical or metaphysical speculation. Each of the steps is actually very simple. And as we'll see tonight, the difficulty is in being persistent and being sincere in wanting to integrate these steps into our lives. So the first step that the book is built upon is the recognition that God exists. As we mentioned last week, that we often feel that that's sort of a needless step to begin at, because we all, in this endeavor, think we already have a belief in God. We know that God exists. And so the Sefer Bilvavi asks the question, how do we know that? What kind of knowledge do we have when we say that we believe in God? You know, we all know, it probably isn't a breathing person on the planet who doesn't know who won the presidential elections in the United States. If you probably ask anyone on the planet, they'll know who won the election in the United States. But the question is, how do we know that? Do I know it as someone here living in Toronto, Canada, who read it in the newspaper? Or do I know that in the same way that Michelle Obama knows it, or Barack Obama knows it? Obviously, their knowledge of having won the presidency is a knowledge they live with. It animates every moment of their day. It's really part of, it's who they are. It is them, right? This is the, this is a knowledge which is not just an intellectual fact that they happen to know and they file it away in the back of their heads like we do. I don't think about it all day long. And most people in the world don't think about the fact that Barack Obama won the election all day long. So our knowledge of that information is on a very different level than the knowledge of the Obamas themselves. It's what the Sefer, the Obamian Mishkan Evne, differentiates between different kinds of knowledge. They speak about Chachma and Bina and Das. Chachma is basically the knowledge of facts, information. It's a piece of information. Bina is when we're able to take that information and reason with it and manipulate it and derive other information from that basic information. But Das is a very, very personal and emotional becoming at one with that information. It's where we basically have taken ownership of that information, and we live with it. We live with it constantly throughout our day. So we're intimate with that knowledge. The word Das in Hebrew is the word that's used in the Bible for physical intimacy, for that Adam knew Eve, his wife. That the Hebrew word there is Lada'at. And so that's the level of knowledge that we're trying to reach. So while we all feel that we do believe that there's a God in the world, and if we were asked that question on a test, we would write down, yes, there is a God. The thing we have to work towards is an awareness of that God that permeates our consciousness throughout the day. That's really the work, the spiritual work that the book tries to prescribe. How do we develop an awareness of God's existence and God's reality that is not simply a fact or a piece of information that sits in the back of our mind and that it's pushed to the outer recesses of our consciousness? How do we bring it to the forefront of our consciousness? How do we go through the day much in the same way that a mother is always aware that she has a baby somewhere? And even if the baby isn't in her arms, the baby may be with a babysitter and the mother may be at a doctor's appointment. The mother is still always her consciousness. And a businessman who is working 12 hours in an office somewhere, he's always aware during the day from moment to moment that he's a businessman. And that knowledge of who he is as a businessman animates his day. It's something which never leaves his consciousness. And so that's the challenge here. And the Sefer Bilvavi basically prescribes that we spend time during the day, regularly during the day, taking a few moments regularly with the goal of maybe every 15 minutes. Maybe that's starting off too much. Maybe you start off with just once an hour. But it's probably not too much for once every hour to spend a minute thinking to ourselves, saying out loud, I know that you exist, God. Just saying it. Maybe having a text message sent to ourselves. Computer is a screensaver. Maybe just having a little note that we have pasted on our desk somewhere. Maybe to open up a book and just read it out of a book and just say it to ourselves, I know that you exist, God. And be able to just make that mental connection regularly throughout the day. You know, it doesn't sound like it's going to really accomplish that much. It sounds like it's a trivial exercise. But it's basically like exercising our body. That if a person makes exercise a regular routine during their day, if they do it once in their lifetime, it's not going to really be effective. All day, 45 minutes, an hour, so that time is what builds up over time and strengthens your physical muscles. And much in the same way that Rabbi Akiva was drawn to embrace Torah because he saw this very visual image of the water that's constantly dripping on the rock and boring a hole through it, So he understood that it, drop by drop, that it may not look like it's really doing anything, but over time, those drops will permeate. And so if we do this exercise over a period of months or even a few years, where every hour, once at least, and hopefully twice or three or four times during the hour, to pause for a few seconds, for a few moments, and just become aware of the fact that there's a God in the world, that God exists, and to make that, just to bring it to the forefront of your consciousness, what he says is that that will ultimately begin to seep into your neshama. It'll become something that you not just know, but you'll begin to feel that as well. Again, much in the same way that the mother feels the presence of her child. It's the goal to bring knowledge from our head into our heart. As the Torah says in the book of Deuteronomy, in Dvarim, that we say every day in our prayers, V'yadata hayom v'hashevota el vavecha. You have to know this day, but then you have to bring it to your heart. To know something intellectually is very, very easy. But to take that head knowledge and to bring it into our hearts is really the goal of spiritual work. And so what the author of the Sefer Blavavi recommends that we do are these mini meditations throughout the day. People often assume that meditation is not part of Judaism. It's very, very untrue. It's been part of Judaism since the very first Jews that walked the planet. As a matter of fact, last week in the Torah we read, meditate, according to some translations, in the field. And our rabbis tell us that in the times of the Talmud, the sages, the great sages, would meditate before they prayed. They meditate to get themselves into a proper mood for prayer. But meditation was always part of Judaism, and Rabbi Itamar Schwartz, the author of this book, is prescribing that we spend time throughout the day contemplating and meditating and doing these awareness exercises. The second thing as part of the program is not just to do the meditation, but to pray. So it would mean throughout the day saying just a very informal prayer in your own words, asking God for help to implant this consciousness in your heart. Very simple prayer. God, I want very much to become aware of your presence throughout the day. Please help me implant that awareness in my heart. And to make that kind of a simple, heartfelt prayer, again, not just once a day, but throughout the day. Now, the second step of the program, again, the second step is to believe not just that there's a God, but that the God created everything in the world, including each of us. Now, again, we often assume that that's caught up, that's all part of the belief in God. But what the author of this Sefer points out is that there are people who believe that there is a God, but don't believe that God created everything. He points out, for example, Pharaoh, we're told in the book of Yechezkel, Pharaoh said, I created the Nile. I created myself. And so he says that one of the reasons the Torah has these personalities, we call wicked personalities, we have a lot of villains in the Bible, he suggests that one of the reasons that the Torah even mentions these villains is because we really each have a little bit of this villain in each of us. We all have inside of us a little Pharaoh. And that little Pharaoh is telling us, well, yeah, sure, there's a God somewhere out there, but he didn't create you. I'll just give you an example of why this is significant. There is a technique that's used in certain therapies to treat trauma. And what they do is it's called the manipulation of submodalities. So if someone, for example, is terrified today of dogs, they're totally terrified of dogs. Why? Because when they were a child, they were attacked by a dog. A huge dog leaped at them and barked very loud. That didn't even bite them, but it just lunged at them, and it was so terrifying that they've been terrified of dogs now throughout their life. So one of the ways that this might be treated is to ask the person to go back to that experience and to imagine it happening right now, but to see it on a screen. So imagine that you're watching this experience on a movie screen. And they might ask the person, when you see this experience now that you had back when you were 7 years old, is the screen very close to you, maybe 2 or 3 feet away, or is the screen very, very far away? And so the person who obviously is still terrified of the dog might say, well, you know, I look at this experience, the screen looks like it's just, you know, a foot or two away. It's very close. And they might be asked, well, how large is the screen? Is it, you know, a very, very large screen, or is it a tiny little screen that you might see on a cell phone? So I say, no, it's huge. It's, you know, it's the size of a window. I mean, it's the size of the wall of my house. I mean, it's a huge screen. They say, when you see this picture, do you see it in black and white or do you see it in color? No, it's vivid color. It's full color. When you hear the dog barking in this film, is it very loud or is it sort of muffled and quiet? No, it's tremendous. It's so loud. What is the pitch of the dog? Is it? It's a very, very frightening pitch, a very deep and violent kind of bark. And they might go through, you know, an analysis of this scene that the person is watching and is rewatching their whole life, and find that the person has a very close experience of this attack, of this event. And so the therapist might say, you know what I want you to do is the following. I want you to take the screen and shrink it down. Maybe instead of being a screen that's 10 feet by 10 feet, make it a screen that's only, you know, 4 inches by 3 inches. Really shrink it all the way down. And then what I want you to do is take the screen and don't have it 3 feet in front of you. Push it to the other side of the room where it's now 12 feet away. And what I want you to do now is take this picture, which is, you're saying it's color, and now make it black and white. And what I want you to do is take the volume and turn it down quite a bit. And then I want you to take the pitch, the tone of the dog, and to make it very, very high pitched. So rather than having a very full-bodied bark, which is very, very frightening, maybe the dog will have a squeaky, high-pitched kind of sound that comes out of it. And so what happens now is that when the person is asked to watch this film, you know, they're going to see an experience which is very, very far away and very small, and it has very, very little impact. So when the person saw this this film, this screen of this event from when they were 7 years old, and it's in full color, and it's large, and it's right in front of them, it's very, very impactful. It's very frightening. But if you take this screen, and the way you see it now is it's a very small screen, and it's black and white, and it's far away, so the impact that that kind of image has is very attenuated. And so what the author of the Sefer Bilvavi is trying to do is to have us bring our image of God closer to us. Because what happens is it's very easy for us to imagine a God out there somewhere. It's even easy for us to imagine that, sure, God created Adam and Eve. Because that's a God that's very far away, that's out there. But if we imagine that God isn't just out there having created Adam and Eve, but that God created me, God created me, that brings the screen very, very close. And it's a little bit uncomfortable, because having God that close to you has a tendency to cramp your style. Meaning that if we imagine that God is out there somewhere and not really, you know, living right next to me, so to speak, I have more of a sense of independence. You know, when a shoplifter goes shopping and the security guard is sort of half asleep sitting at the door, so he feels comfortable as a shoplifter. But when the shoplifter goes into the store and there are 3 armed guards that are just within a few feet of him or her, it's not so comfortable. So we have a tendency to want to have an image of God as not being that close to us. And so the second step in the Seferness, the Sefer Bilvavi Mishkan Evneh, is to not just be aware that God exists, but to be aware that that God created everything that exists, including ourselves. The Talmud says that there are three partners in the creation of every person. There's their mother, their father, and God. So each of us was created by God, and we have to be aware of the fact that there's a little bit of Pharaoh inside of us. The author, Rabbi Schwartz, says that each one of us has a little tiny Pharaoh that tries to whisper to us, no, God didn't create you. God didn't create you. There might be a God in the world. Pharaoh said, I do believe in God. But that God didn't make the Nile. That God didn't make me. I somehow made myself. I'm my own person. So this is the second step that we have to try to acquire. It means bringing God in very, very close. Now, the Sefer Blavavi points out a very interesting idea from the Chafetz Chaim. He says that the Chafetz Chaim said that whenever he experienced some kind of a spiritual weakness in his life, you can imagine what the Chafetz Chaim experienced as a spiritual weakness. He was one of the great, great Jewish righteous sages that lived in the early part of the 20th century. He died, I think, in the year 1933. His faults were probably very remote from the kind of things that most of us deal with. But he said that whenever he felt a spiritual weakness, maybe he didn't study as much Torah as he would like to during the day, or maybe he felt frustrated by the people that came to ask his advice all day long. So he said that any spiritual failing, any spiritual weakness, is really stemming from the root cause is a failure to really believe that God created us. He felt that if we really had a consciousness that God created each of us, it would be almost impossible to speak negatively of other people. It would be very difficult to get angry. Be very difficult to overeat and stuff yourself. I mean, he felt that any time we do something wrong, it's because we really lose consciousness. We're not in touch with, on a very deep and real level, on a level of das, of intimate knowledge, with the idea that God really created us. Rav Nachman of Breslov would say that if we have difficulties praying, and again, many of us struggle with this, we don't feel necessarily inspired all the time from our prayers. Rabbi Nachman of Breslov would say that the problems that we have in prayer stem from a weakness in our faith. Meaning that if we had a pure and total faith in the reality of God and God's existence and in God's relationship to us, it would be very natural to pray and to speak to God, and to speak to God in a very spontaneous and real way. It wouldn't be a difficult thing to do at all. And so the fact that we have difficulty praying, or that we feel we find it hard to connect with what we're saying, is because we don't really have a very profound, personal, real, simple kind of faith in God's existence. And so the program that the Sefer Blavavi recommends is that we build faith in the idea that God created the world and God created us. And the technique for doing this is built upon a teaching from the Passover Haggadah. We know that the law is that the Seder has to begin with questions. You have to have questions to begin the Seder. Because real education, real learning, only takes place once there are questions. A question basically is a statement that I want to know. I need to know. I have to find out. And when a person doesn't really have a desire to know and a desire to find out, whatever answer they get is not going to really end up living deep in their heart and deep in their consciousness. So any kind of real educational experience has to have questions being asked. And so what the Chafetz Chaim would do, and this sounds strange to us, is he would study the story of the creation of the world, and he'd study it like a child would study it, with questions and answers. And he'd read the Torah. He'd say, and God created in the beginning the heavens and the earth. And he would say, who created the heavens and the earth? And he would point, it's you, Hashem, it's you, God, who created the heavens and the earth. And he would say, Did the heavens and the earth get here all by themselves? Did they just sort of materialize with a big bang? No. The Torah says that you, Hashem, created everything in the world. And he would point out in the Sefer Bilvavi, it's one of the themes that he points out, is we're often not comfortable speaking to God directly in the second person. We often want to speak about God in the third person. We would want to say, did the world get here all by itself? And we might say, no, it's God who created the world. So we're speaking about God there in the third person. But he recommends, when possible, that we try to speak to God in the second person. We say, it's you, Hashem, that created the heavens and the earth. And he would go through the story of creation, not because he didn't know who created the world. Of course, on the level of knowledge, head knowledge, intellectual knowledge, on the level of chachma, of course the Chafetz Chaim knew that God created the heavens and the earth. But he felt that there was a gap between that intellectual head knowledge of chachma and an emotional feeling of that knowledge. That the fact that he feels it deeply in his consciousness as he goes through the day, the level of da'as, he was trying to work on that. Again, we all know that Barack Obama won the presidential election, but we don't know it in the same way that Barack Obama knows it. And so the goal here is not just to know that God created the world as a piece of information, but to really be able to assimilate that knowledge into our moment-to-moment emotional heart consciousness as we go through the day. So we don't just know it, but we feel it. And it's a work that really takes place on the level of our neshama. The third step of the program is to go one step further. Once we've assimilated the idea that there's a God that exists, and we really live with that during the day, we don't lose contact with that idea. Right? We're able to sort of attain an awareness throughout the day that there's a God, and to go one step further to really believe that that God created everything in the world, including ourselves. The next step in the program is to understand that God didn't just create everything in the world, but that God continues to supervise and maintain everything that takes place in the world. This is what we call in Hebrew hashgacha pratit, that God has a supervision over the world and a supervision over everything in the world. Which means that we're not supposed to believe, of course, that God created the world at one point and then left on a holiday. Or, probably the more prevalent idea, that there are other forces that control what takes place in our lives. Now, it's hard for us to imagine going over to a statue and bowing down to it and worshiping it. When we read about idolatry, we have an image of very unsophisticated people who were very primitive, and they worshipped, you know, either animals or totem poles. But the truth is that we do harbor the sensation, at least, it's not the intellectual belief, but the sensation that there are other forces that are in control of our lives. When we think about our security and our ability to pay our bills and our ability to function in this life, we often look towards our job. We look towards our bank account. We think about having enough money or not having enough money. And we often, as the United States currency says, you know, not in God we trust, but we trust in the dollar itself. Or a job, having a job. When we think about how we get healed when we're sick, God forbid, right? We often put our trust and put our faith in the doctor or in the medicine that we're taking. So the goal here is not as easy as we think it is. We might, again, if we were asked on a test, you know, does God supervise everything that happens in the world? Does God run the world? We would say, sure he does. You know, we know that, supposedly. We know that in terms of it being the correct answer. But do we really feel, is it something that we really feel deeply, if we're sick, that the control over whether we will be healthy or not lies totally in the hands of God? Or do we have a large part of our trust and focus placed upon the doctors that we see or the medicine that we take? These are what we might call modern-day idolatries. Who does heal us? And I think that what happens is we have at least part of our consciousness and hope and trust and focused on our hospitals, on our doctors, on the medicine that we're taking. One of the ways that we can measure this is by asking ourselves, what have we prayed for lately? What do people pray for? And if you take a poll of people, people might say that, you know, they prayed recently because a close relative was very sick, and they prayed for that. Or someone might say that, you know, they lost their job and they were praying that they'd be able to find a new job. Or people might talk about, you know, needing to sell, you know, to sell their house if they're going to move, and they were praying that somehow they'd be able to sell their house. And what's interesting is that when you speak to people or think about what kind of things we often pray for, they turn out to be very big things. They're very big things. There's a passage in the Talmud in Tractate Brachot, page 8, the first side, 8a, where it says the following. It says, Al zot yitpalel kol chasid elecha le'et mitzo. That for this, every person should pray when these things are needed. So then Talmud's going to list a number of different things that people would pray for, that they thought that this is something that you really have to pray for when it becomes necessary. So the first opinion is that you should pray for a spouse. That's something that everyone can relate to. This is probably the most significant relationship in your life, and so we should pray that we find the appropriate spouse and that we don't have to spend so many years looking for a spouse, and that we understand that's something that we can relate to. The next opinion is for Torah, that we should pray that we should be able to understand the Torah, that we should be able to find the appropriate classes to go to, that we should find good teachers, that we should have success in studying Torah. That's understandable. Then they speak about the need to pray for an appropriate or easy death, that it comes time for everyone to die. So it shouldn't be a horrible death. It should be an easy death. We can all relate to that. Another opinion says you should pray for a burial, that the burial should be to take place. It shouldn't be too difficult. And the Rashi points out, I think, that in where this was taught, it wasn't so easy to find a place to bury people. The ground wasn't always easy to dig up. And so sometimes you've got to be able to pray for something like that. And the final opinion is that you should pray to find a bathroom when you need it. So, I mean, this sounds like it's different than all the others. It sounds like an everyday occurrence that you might have to pray for several times during the day. We don't always have to pray for a spouse that you do once in your life, and, you know, praying when it comes time to die or to be buried. But this teacher said, no, what a person should really have focus for is they should pray when they need a bathroom, they should find a bathroom. It shouldn't be too far away. It shouldn't be filthy. You know, it sounds so minuscule. It sounds so trivial compared to the other prayers. And the Talmud says that, according to the consensus of the rabbis, this is the most significant of the prayers, meaning that the most significant, the most important of all the prayers mentioned, more than a wife and more than finding a burial place, is that you should be able to find a bathroom when you need it. So what we see here is that prayer is not only for those big things in life, but we should pray for little things in life, small things. Again, that's part of our problem, is that we have pushed God to the sidelines, where we assume that God is only involved with those big, significant, rare moments of our lives. You know, when God forbid, once in a while, when someone's very, very sick. It doesn't happen every single day. We occasionally are thrown into a crisis situation. And so the third step in the Sefer Lvivi is to become conscious of the fact that God actually controls everything in the world, not just who we end up marrying. And it's interesting, if you speak to many people, they'll tell you that they had a sense that finding their spouse was not just an accident, but they really feel that this is, was arranged by God. In fact, the Talmud says, it's a cute story, that one of the Roman matrons challenged one of the great rabbis and said, God created the world, fine, we all believe that, but what does God do now since he created the world? What is he spending his time doing? And the rabbi said that God spends his time helping pair up men and women that they should marry each other. And this woman was incredulous and said, that's ridiculous. You don't need God to do that. I can do that. And she got 1,000 slaves, 1,000, paired them up, men and the women. Next morning they came back. This one had a broken arm and this one had a black eye. So she realized it's not so simple. But people that are married will often say that I can really sense that finding this soulmate, really had God's handprint on it. People might tell you the same thing in terms of the house they're living in. They might say the same thing about the city they ended up moving to. There's a feeling that this was really directed by God. And so we are comfortable doing that when it comes to these large, significant, occasional events of our life, because that's a God that's out there, and he somehow pops up into our life at these big moments once in a while. But the Sefer Lvivi is saying to us that the avodah that we have here, the spiritual work here, is to develop a consciousness throughout the day that God really runs everything that takes place in our life. And therefore, we should go through the day thinking about who ultimately controls every little thing that we do during the day. Who controls whether or not I'm going to arrive at my destination on time? Who's in charge of that? Who's in control of that? Who controls whether or not this medication I'm about to take? Right? I've been taking this pill every day for the past 10 years. Who controls whether or not this pill is going to be helpful? Who determines whether I'm going to be successful in the meeting I'm going to? Who controls whether I'm going to catch a cold today? So that's a consciousness that we have to work towards developing. And the author of the Sefer Lvivi says that what we need to do is first nullify the notion that we or anything else in the world is in control of what happens to us. It's a voice of our Yetzer Hara, our evil inclination, which tries to tell us that, as Pharaoh said, God doesn't run the show. And so we have this little evil inclination which whispers to us, we don't even be conscious of it, but whispers to us that, no, you're in control of your life. You're in control. Don't have to think that God takes care of everything. We have a little voice which says, God isn't so interested in the details. God has got more important things to worry about. That's a thing that we have to fight. We have to really overcome and nullify the notion that there are things other than God that controls the world. And so what happens in this program is to spend, again, time every day and every hour of the day for several minutes during the hour contemplating our existence. When you're, let's say, sitting in your house after dinner, to ask yourself, and again, this is in a question and answer format, who lives here? You're sitting in your living room in a nice chair, and you ask yourself, who lives here? Say it out loud. And you might say, well, I live here, and name all the people that's in the house. My wife lives here as well, and we have X number of children. And then you say, well, who determined that she should be my wife? And then we point. So you, Hashem, you, God, determined that she's to be my wife. And who gave us these children in the house? You, God, gave us these children. You, God, gave us these children. And then you ask, was it I who was in control of these things? Right? We answer ourselves, no, God, it was you who was in control of all these things. And the program is just a meditation, a few moments of contemplating, articulating, speaking out. I mentioned last week that the Sefer Nesiva Shalom quotes the verse in the book of Psalms, which says, "Emanti ki adaber," that my faith comes through speaking it. So when we speak about these things, we articulate them, we speak them out, it actually builds faith. It's a way of building faith in our souls. So we shouldn't just think about these issues mentally, contemplate them internally, we should actually speak them out verbally. And the goal of this kind of prolonged contemplation is for it to ultimately take root in our hearts. Again, that's the overall goal of this book, is that information and knowledge that we have in our heads should seep into our hearts and become something that we actually feel emotionally, that we feel it. And then we're told that it's important to articulate any kind of contrary feelings. We should do that, again, as part of our contemplation during the day. We should say out loud, you know, it seems like, it feels like I was in control of which car I would purchase. That's what it felt like. It felt like I was actually in control. But the Torah says, Hakol bidei shamayim, chutz meyirat shamayim, that everything is in the hands of God except for one thing, except for my fear of God or my relationship to God, whether I'm going to choose to be in relationship with God, whether I'm going to choose to obey God. That's the only thing that's not in the control of God. God does not allow us to control the non-spiritual details of our lives. We don't control where we're born. We don't control how much money we're going to make in the year. We don't control what our health is going to be. We don't control anything. We don't control whether or not we're going to arrive at our appointment on time. So we have to articulate the contrary feelings and say, you know what? It felt like I was controlling. I was in control of which house I would purchase. And we have to say, no, God, I know that it was only you who determined which house I would end up in. It's not true that I was in control. Again, to speak these issues out. I felt like I was in control, but I know, God, that you were ultimately in control. Again, this contemplation should be done every day. I know he recommends a goal of an hour. Now, I know that for most of us, to do this for an hour in the beginning is not going to be so easy, and so it's probably better to begin with 15 minutes of this kind of contemplation, of sitting in your apartment or sitting in your house and contemplating, where did everything come from? Who is living here? Who decided that this was going to be the case? And to speak about each thing that we have, each person that we're related to, and again, verbally spell out who determined what this was going to be. And to build up, hopefully, from 15 minutes a day to a half hour, and then sometime in the future to an hour. But then to spend a few moments every hour with a mini meditation. So this is two parts of the program now. Once a day, a period of serious contemplation, 15 minutes, half hour, an hour. And then during the day, every hour for a few moments. And hopefully build up to two times an hour, and then three times an hour, and then every 15 minutes to pause for a few moments and to think about this, to think about God's supervision and control over everything that takes place in the world. And then as we go through the day, to actually articulate this, to speak out and say, I'm going to a meeting now. Only Hashem, only God can determine what is going to happen, if I'm going to be successful or not. I'm going to teach this class in a few minutes. Only God can determine whether or not I'm going to be successful. With God's help, I can be successful. I'm going to this doctor's appointment in a few minutes. It's only up to God to determine whether or not the doctors are going to be successful. One of the things that the author of the Sefer Bilvavi says, and it's one of the most striking things in his book, is that there is a test where you can see if his program, if this program is working. Meaning that when a person begins to assimilate these steps into their life, the first step to become aware of God's presence throughout the day, the second step to become aware of the fact that God created us and everything in the world, and the third step to become connected to the idea that God controls everything that takes place in the world. He says that if you actually become successful in doing that, you're going to notice that you feel angry a lot less during the day. That it's going to be impossible to be an angry person to the extent that we might have been previously if we've made progress in assimilating these ideas into our consciousness. I mean, basically, we're not able to entertain two conflicting concepts in our consciousness at the same time. So if we really have a feeling that God runs the show and that God loves us, God doesn't relate to us with anything other than love. And so if we really have that kind of consciousness and we realize that everything that takes place in our lives is ultimately for our best, as the rabbis would say, Gam Zulatova, it's all for the best. Or Kol Nada Ovid Rahmana Latav, everything that God does is for the good. So if we really feel that way, and we really manage to take ownership over that concept, and to feel it very deeply in our hearts, it's going to be very difficult to get enraged over many of the things that throw us into angry fits during our day. And so this is one of the tests that the author of the Sefer Bilvavi suggests is able to be a marker to really help us see whether or not we're making progress. The last piece that I wanted to share tonight is that we should realize that this awareness that God controls everything that takes place in our lives, and to appreciate this, we all know that we'll get tested at some point in our life. This is the very weighty and difficult problem philosophically of Tzadik V'Ra'lo. You know, that when very, very horrible things happen to us, that really is running straight into, it's colliding with the consciousness that God runs the world and everything in it, and it's ultimately all for our best. And so I think that it's important as we try to practice the steps of the Sefer Bilvavi, not to go about it naively and think that it's going to be simple to take ownership over these ideas and to really begin living them fully in our consciousness and in our hearts, because there are going to be very difficult times in every person's life when these ideas will be challenged. But I think what's important is to understand that a person who has developed this kind of profound relationship with God is going to go through these challenges much more, in a much different way than someone who didn't develop this kind of very close and intimate relationship with God. Everyone goes through difficulties. Everyone goes through trials and tribulations. So the person that's built up over the course of months and years a very, very deep and profound intimacy with God, where they really do feel God's presence in their life from moment to moment, when they go through a crisis and a difficulty and a tragedy, they'll be seeing that in a different context than people who don't really have that kind of moment-to-moment relationship with God, maybe only have a connection to God very rarely, and now in that kind of person's life, a tragedy comes. They will have a much more difficult time dealing with that tragedy and dealing with God, because there's much less of a context for it. The last step in tonight's class is to, as we begin to see godliness in everything in the world and to see God's supervision and participation and control of everything that takes place in our world, the author of the Sefer Bilvavi says that we enter into what he calls the world of prayer. It's the world of prayer. It's not simply that we pray three times a day as a religious obligation. It's not simply that, you know, part of what we do during the day is to pray at special times, to pray the morning prayers, to pray the afternoon prayers, to pray the evening prayers, but we enter the world of prayer. The word tefillah, he tells us, in Hebrew, is related to the words in Hebrew for to be entangled with, to be attached to. So really, prayer is all about attaching ourselves to become entangled with God. As King David said, Va'ani tefillah, I am prayer. So, as I heard expressed by someone not long ago, the reason that we go to the synagogue to pray is because we are praying people. If we are people who are always praying, then sometimes we do it in a synagogue. But what the Sefer Bilvavi encourages us to do is to pray literally before every single thing that we do and experience throughout the day. So if we're going to a meeting, to just pray and say, God, I'm going to this meeting, and I know that you're ultimately in control. Please, God, give me the wisdom to participate in this meeting properly. And please, God, help me emerge successfully from this experience. If we're going to a doctor, to see a doctor, God, I know ultimately that you're in control of my health and of everything else in the world. I'm praying to you, God, please, to help me have a successful appointment to the doctor, and that he should have the skill and the wisdom to be able to treat me appropriately. If you're going on a trip, to get into the car and to pray and to say, God, I know that ultimately only you can control whether I'm going to get there on time and whether it's going to be a safe trip, and I'm praying to you to please help me in this journey, in this trip. And there are many things to pray for. You know, I want to pray, God, that when we need gas, we're able to find a place to sell gas, and that we don't, you know, end up having to see things that we shouldn't be seeing. And if, God forbid, we see something on the way, like an accident, to pray for the people in the accident, to pray that they get help quickly and that they're able to, you know, get to the hospital, get seen by a doctor on time. There are so many things that we experience during the day, both activities that we go through and things that we witness. We might be walking down the street and pass a school. It's not inappropriate to pray and to say, God, I want to bless all the students in that school. I want to pray that you help them all learn properly and help their teachers teach them properly. It's not only activities that we're going through. It's not only things that we're doing, but it's possible when we enter the world of prayer to be like Tevye from Fiddler on the Roof. And Tevye walked through the day, and he walked with God. He went shopping. He took God with him. He went to the fair to buy a horse. He took God with him. He went to the tailor to get some of his clothing tailored. He took God with him. And so it's possible, as we're going through the day, to literally enter the world of prayer, where every single activity is something that we're able to pray for and pray about, and every experience we have, we're able to use, again, as a way of connecting to God. We made it through practically three-quarters, maybe even more, of the Sefer Bilvavi, of the book, In My Heart, I Will Create a Sanctuary. I want to recommend that any of you that were with me here for the past 3 weeks, go online. The book is available for free online in several different languages. And to not just study this book, but I think that you'll find a tremendous blessing in your life if you try to put into practice the avoda, the work that the author, the tzaddik who wrote this book, offers to help us connect to our Father in Heaven, to the Almighty, and to feel that presence in our lives moment to moment throughout the day, deeply and warmly in our hearts. So I want to thank all of you for attending and thank Torah in Motion for organizing the class, and wish everyone a good night.